Hi, my name is Sam Blezard. Welcome to Comms from the Shed, the interview show where you get to hear from a range of diverse and interesting voices on how they've coped during the global pandemic. In this series, we'll be taking an informal look at life, talking to people who've been doing incredible things, and asking them about their hopes for the future in both their personal and professional lives. Hope you enjoy it. I'm delighted to have with me today Sean Randall, whose professional career started at Bloomberg, and who has also started publications online and in print, which include The Mantle and Mr. Editorial. Sean recently joined Splunk, and he's joined us today to talk about all things communication. So, Sean, welcome to Comms from the Shed.
Thank you for inviting me into your shed. It's a privilege.
I mentioned in my intro there that your professional career started at Bloomberg, which is, you know, an organization that's known around the world. What are your memories of that time, and how did you come to be an employee at Bloomberg?
I have nothing but fond memories and great things to say about Bloomberg, working there as an organization and working for its visionary and entrepreneur founder, CEO, Mike Bloomberg, who was also a three-time mayor of New York City, which is where I was living. And many people around the world know the company for its news service, Bloomberg Television, Bloomberg News. But really, that's about 15, 20% of the business. The bulk of the company's business is in finance, fintech, and data and analytics. And I thought this would be a great opportunity for me to just become a journalist and work for Bloomberg News. But it wasn't so straightforward and so easy as that. And while I did have the opportunity to publish for Bloomberg News and Business Week magazine and so on, at the same time, I was writing stories for their internal news wire for internal communications that had just started as just a way to practice to write and edit and be edited and interview people. But pretty soon the manager of that internal comms newswire resigned to go write a novel. So I stepped in and filled that slot. When I joined the employee communications team, I did it so that I could write news stories and interview people and just is a global company. It was an opportunity for me to learn about other cultures and other societies and just put a corporate spin on it for the internal newswire. I had no idea that there was a profession called communications. It was an opportunity, an eye-opening opportunity for me to learn about a new profession and really grow, help grow a team of four disparate actors. You know, we had one person who was a video producer, one person who ran digital signage. I ran the newswire. Over the course of 10 or 12 years, we ended up, I guess it was 10 years, we regrew that into a sophisticated, like, international operation that was sophisticated and multi-channel publishing and strategic and integrated with PR and external communications and so on and so forth. So I really cut my teeth in communications at Bloomberg, and it was an extraordinary experience.
I mean, that's quite a thing, isn't it? Moving from data analytics, you know, stocks, macroeconomics, banking risk to comms. But it does sound like you learned everything from the ground up. So yeah, how do you think, you know, having to establish a comms function over 10 years to a point where it was a sophisticated and strategic multi-channel operation, how has that stood you in good stead sort of in your current career, do you think?
Doing something from scratch really gives you an appreciation for the 360-degree operation that it takes to run in any sort of operation and team. And just as we were talking before the recording about, you know, learning to podcast, for example, if you're doing it by yourself, doing any project by yourself, you suddenly learn technical skills, new technology, research, preparation, new communication skills, relationship management, branding, marketing, a lot of those things, whether you're starting a startup business out of your garage, a new media platform, an employee communications team, you know, those are factors and experiences that are applicable through different avenues. Splunk gave me an opportunity to start something similar with an editorial program there. We have an internal communications team that is in an exciting phase, rebuilding and reinventing itself and growing. And since I've been there in just past 6 months, I think the team itself has grown at least 50%. The one thing that I don't have high-level experience in, and I'm not sure I really want it, is to be the head of internal communications. I prefer to be behind the scenes, and I'm a deep introvert, and the last place I really want to be on any given day is at the table with the C-suite. So I've always appreciated the opportunity to work under someone else who has that wherewithal and spirit to interact at the higher levels of the company and appreciate that and learn from that person. But that's not where I'm most comfortable. I think very few people, I think, would admit they're comfortable going only so high in a corporate ladder.
It's interesting because you'll have seen me laughing in the background because I bear the scars probably. And also the good times and great experiences of being a head of internal comms for many years for more than one organization. And, you know, there are fantastic things about that. And the responsibility of it is a privilege. To fulfill that role is a really interesting and fascinating one. I don't think I ever took it for granted. But I also kind of admire what you're saying there, actually, about being very comfortable in the spot you're in. We'll go on to talk about your Mr. Editorial enterprise, which is how you first came to my attention. And actually, I think it's got a tremendous amount of personality in it. I think at my heart, as somebody who loves communications and loves the employee communications aspect of it specifically, and now people that then call that human stories, or they call it, you know, engagement, but deep down, I think I'm a journalist at heart. You know, if you strip everything away, I think that's why I've created these podcasts, to scratch an itch. You know, I think I like interrogating sort of leadership or articulating strategy because I'm trying to present, not in any way a dumbed down version, but maybe it's a headline version, something that people can pick up and easily understand. Do you think at heart that you're really a journalist too? I mean, just listening to your introductory answer, is that really your kind of beating heart?
Absolutely. Before I was in communications, even throughout a lot of my career in communications, I was writing for and publishing for other organizations, doing interviews, criticism, essays, not journalism. I was never trained as a news journalist, but an essayist, a contributor, critic, that kind of literary spot I filled in a lot of publications. And when I was thinking about joining Bloomberg News, it wasn't to do breaking news or investigative journalism on corporate America, but rather it was the arts and culture section that I wanted to join. And it was for that section of Bloomberg News that I was publishing before I joined communications. I often describe my role that I've been able to carve out in internal communications as that of an editor-in-chief of a magazine. The analogy is apt for many reasons. For one, if you think about a magazine, it has a particular agenda, a point of view, and so does internal and corporate communications. You have to support some sort of vision. From there, just like with a magazine, you have different sections. You have publication deadlines. You have different media that are required to keep the attention of your readers. And those same tactics and attributes apply to internal communications as well. People who are not in internal communications, i.e. Leadership, are always shocked and dismayed that 100% of employees are not reading 100% of internal communications. That is a hard lesson internal communications professions learn within 3 months on the job. Because I subscribe to magazines, I do not read every article. I certainly flip through it and I get the headlines and I get the graphics and images and advertisements, and I absorb them and I read what I want to read, what matters and is important to me. And that's how employees behave with employee communications as well. They'll scan the headlines of the intranet or the newsletter, and they'll click on the things that matter most to them. It gives you a foot in the door to knock on anyone's door around the company and say, hey, I'd like to talk to you. It's for the employee newsletter. It's for the intranet. It's for the employee podcast. We'd like to make a video. Any sort of person, department, corner of the company that I find interesting, I have a pass to approach that person and have that conversation. I love the art of the interview. It's my favorite part of employee communications, and then being able to write a story about that as well.
I mean, I really like the way you've described internal communication or employee communication. I like the lens that you view it all with. I think that's why I asked you about whether you believe you're a journalist at heart, because when I worked at Dow Jones and I saw your Mr. Editorial newsletter for the first time, I think I realized that you saw it through a slightly different lens. And it's really good to hear you, to finally meet you and hear you articulate that. You started the mantle as a side hustle while you were at Bloomberg, and you've described it as part online magazine and part print book publishing. Can you just tell us a little bit about what The Mantle was?
The Mantle, I started more than 10 years ago, I think 11 years ago this month. It very much mirrored my own personal intellectual interests. It was started off as an online magazine with sections on arts and culture, international affairs, philosophy. Turned out that the philosophy content has ended up being our most popular content. It is online. It is a magazine that features young, emerging intellectuals, journalists, writers from around the world expressing their views or reporting on content that may be censored or not be able to get the attention that is needed in their home country, or because they are not established as a writer or a journalist or an author or an academic, they need an outlet on which to publish. I started it because I had gone through graduate school and had an incredible experience in the international affairs department of being in classrooms of 9 or 10 people from 9 or 10 different countries around the world, really expanding my mind and exposure to different points of view, different cultures, different societies, really smart individuals with pointed things to say about society and culture. And then when I was reading the journals and magazines that I read to stay abreast of international affairs and culture, I did not see those same voices being reflected. These younger people, 20s and 30s, have something to say. I started The Mantle to give them a place to say it. 5 years in, started publishing our first books, which featured international authors as well, so print and ebooks. And over the past 5 years, published about 20 books, mostly featuring writers from Africa. The Mantle is and was a place where I could be an editor, be a publisher, publish voices and points of view that I think were being under or not represented in Western media or in the home countries writers were from. You know, we publish more than, 200 different writers from more than 100 different countries, and many of those countries are highly censorial. It was a side hustle, and it's right to describe that because it was a nights and weekends project. I would get up early in the morning before work to write, edit, and publish. I would do it in the evenings, and I would do it on Saturdays, giving Sunday, my only day off from it. At the height of my individual experience with it, I was putting in 30, 40 hours a week just on that. Over the course of time, several editors joined the publication and were able to lend a hand.
I'm glad I asked you about it now. It's a really great story that you tell. Which of those experiences and skills do you think you've been able to apply in your internal comms life and your more corporate existence, if you like?
Going back to that conversation we had about starting a team from scratch, starting a project from scratch, starting podcasting from scratch. I mean, I learned web design. I learned how to build a website. I learned logo design and colors and all that stuff. But really the practical element that I've been able to take through me over the past 10, 12 years since running it is editing, being an editor, editing with an international audience, learning how to strip away jargon to make the English more plain and understandable and accessible. When you are a good editor, I think it also makes you a better writer. The other practical lesson I've learned from running the Mantle is the art of the interview. And you are certainly learning that as well with this podcast program. We all enjoy a great interview, but once you become the interviewer, you suddenly realize how much work goes into it. The background research, making sure that you've got more questions than you have time for, putting those questions in an order in which there is a narrative, interesting flow, making sure that your interviewee is prepped and aware of what's coming, but not to show all your cards so that you can have some natural and emotional reactions. And the biggest lesson I learned from interviewing is not to make assumptions. I'll give you a quick story about that. Interviewing is by far my favorite thing to do. Whether it's for Mr. Editorial or Employee Communications, The Mantle, whatever. And it's interesting to be on this side of the microphone right now.
I was going to say, I bet it is interesting to be the interviewee.
Yeah, I was actually really nervous. I still am nervous because I'm never on this side of it. I feel like, I don't have the control that I would normally have as the interviewer. But I had gotten the opportunity to interview Noam Chomsky, and who is a philosopher, linguist, intellectual, activist. It was an opportunity of a lifetime for me because Noam Chomsky's early years in the 1960s, his writings were one of the things that inspired the Mantle to begin with. And to be able to have the opportunity to interview him was a magnificent personal moment for me. And so I had done all the preparation I needed to do. At the time I was interviewing him, the hot political topics in the world, I think this was about the time that the Iran nuclear deal was being negotiated. Kim Jong-un was setting off a nuclear bomb every other week. Nuclear weaponry was just the talk of the town for international affairs. So here I am getting ready to interview Mr. Chomsky, and I had done all the research and preparation for the interview, and I made an assumption for one of his answers, which is a lesson I learned never to do again. And the assumption was I asked him a question about what he thought the greatest threat to humanity was at the moment, something like that. My assumption was that he was going to say nuclear war. And all the rest of my questions were based off of that answer. He surprised me and he said climate change. And I had no rebuttal for that answer. And the rest of my questions did not match the climate change answer. They were all toward international diplomacy and nuclear proliferation and Iran and all this stuff. So that was a huge lesson I learned, because then I stumbled through the rest of the interview because I just wasn't prepared. I was extremely embarrassed and nervous about it as well. The interview came off really flat and trite, rather a disappointment. But that is a lesson I learned for all the high-profile interviews I have done since and all the interviews that I do for corporate communications, is never to assume the answer.
I think it's a good story and a great lesson. And listen, I was chuckling to myself there because I didn't realize you were actually going to deconstruct the entire process of pulling together a podcast within the podcast. Now, I'm going to ask you about Mr. Editorial. So this is how I think you came to my attention. You know, I love the job of employee comms. I love the discipline. I love the profession. And I love communications in general. And like you, I think as mentioned, I'm a journalist at heart, and I too love interviewing. I get an awful lot out of it. It tends to reveal things that you didn't realize you were going to find out when you went into it in the first place. Mr. Editorial, I think, interested me because it was a newsletter, an e-newsletter, and of which all of us in the corporate sphere, or anyone who's got an email account, quite frankly, we all get tens to hundreds to thousands of e-shorts, yeah. E-newsletters, mm-hmm. Some commercial, some corporate in focus. But I was kind of struck straight away by it. There was something about it that appealed to me. And I say this as somebody who's been a head of internal comms, who has, you know, with the help and support of great teams, started e-newsletters and created them from scratch and tried to develop very visual, well-edited content that's based on a less is more philosophy and principle. You know, I think what struck me about Mr. Editorial was there was something slightly irreverent about it, something very journalistic and sort of non-corporate, maybe a little bit mischievous, certainly well curated. When did you get the idea to do it? And I'm also interested in the fact that you charge a subscription service for it, because, you know, frankly, you've had the confidence to say, look, you know, I'm a writer, I know this is good content, and I think there's a premium on charging for it, because I think, you know, more power to you. I do admire the fact that you've had the guts and the nerve to create this really engaging publication, and that actually, you know, you have the confidence to say that it's premium content. So I'm interested in both how you got the idea, why you went for it, and what's the journey like to create a subscription model around something like that?
The newsletter, Mr. Editorial, started as a bit of a gimmick to raise my profile outside of the New York City area. In the employee communication space, I was getting well known in New York for the work that I was doing, and speaking on webinars and at conferences and so on. But when I decided to try my hand at freelancing and consulting and doing some independent work, I didn't have a presence anywhere. I wasn't on Twitter. I wasn't on LinkedIn. I wasn't blogging. And so I thought, as a way for me to drum up business and interest in who I am and my expertise, I'll start this newsletter as a freemium, as a way in to try and get bigger business and some contracts and so on. So that's how it started, as a way to advertise myself beyond the circle that knew me. So then I started a Twitter account, and I started a LinkedIn account, not for personal reasons, but for professional reasons, to promote this Mr. Editorial persona. But it turned out I really loved doing it, and the feedback was more than I had expected. People liked reading it. They liked the content. They were engaged, and which was encouraging for me to keep going. And it turned out, you know, I knew that I was really interested and passionate about employee communications, at least within the corporate sphere in which I was doing it. But I didn't realize that that passion had also carried on to the industry, and just understanding what was happening in the market and in the industry in the U.S. and worldwide. So there was much fuel there. Now, there are two versions of it. There's a weekly version that I put out that's free for anyone. And then there's a bi-weekly edition that goes out for paid subscribers. And that's where I put some of my own experience and expertise. I published that material for those paid subscribers. It was one of my mentors who was my mentor at Bloomberg. His name's Ethan McCarty. He would say, you do good work. People want to learn from you and hear from you. And that's why you're being invited to these things. And I thought, well, I've got 10 years plus experience in this employee communication space. Nobody that I saw was like an industry insider writing about this and charging for it. You know, I look around at other newsletters that have been started during the pandemic and even before, and people are charging for really niche and esoteric topics. There's one guy who started a newsletter that's all about what's happening at historically Black colleges and universities in the United States, personnel moves, funding decisions, so on and so forth. Really niche topic. He charges for it. He makes money off of it. There's another guy who started a newsletter about the business scene in Charlotte, North Carolina. Yeah, okay. You know, a mid-tier American city with a significant, like, sort of Wall Street exposure. A lot of banks work there and hired there. But he starts charging a newsletter about business in Charlotte, and people are paying for it. So I thought, well, maybe people want to pay for a newsletter about internal communications as well.
Would you say that interest in Mr. Editorial has grown in the lockdown? That's part one of my next question. But also, do you think now is the time for more innovation and entrepreneurialism in internal comms?
People continue to subscribe for it, both free versions and paid versions. Because I think, you know, there's just a need for insights into how other people are doing internal communications. Employee communications is so insular, so siloed, because the nature of our work is hidden behind firewalls. When I talk to people, I say, you know, if you're in marketing and you're trying to figure out how to do an interesting campaign for your new product, you can just go outside and look at billboards and magazines and videos and see how the competition is doing marketing for that product. If you're in the shoe business, you just go to the shoe store and see what the competition is doing with shoe design. But for internal communications, because all of our work is published behind firewalls, you cannot see what anybody else is doing. So you can't benchmark yourself, you can't benchmark your team, you can't get ideas. It's all hidden. And so I think people are craving insight into how other people are doing internal communications, because they're just at a loss for ideas, or they're new to communications and they don't know how to do it, and so on. So interest remains strong, and especially as we move into this hybrid return to office environment. It's all new. People have never done this type of communications before, so they like to see how other people might be doing it. But yes, to your question about innovation, right now I am publishing a series of 9 articles for the paid subscribers on how internal communications professionals and teams can overcome the innovator's dilemma. And I don't know if you are familiar with the innovator's dilemma. I mean, look, see this? It's right here on my desk. The Innovator's Dilemma by Clayton Christensen, published in the late 1990s, a classic business book about how successful companies eventually succumb to competition because they are run by good managers who are more prone to stay with the status quo than to adopt innovative techniques and expand their marketplace or build new products. The same lessons that apply to avoiding the innovator's dilemma can be applied to the internal communications profession, where I think professionals, individuals, and teams get into a routine of what is expected of them and what employees expect from communications. And it's too easy to just run that machine without innovating. And before you know it, though, employees have moved on to a new attraction, a new gimmick, a new technology, a new channel, a new outlet to learn about their company, their industry. And the communications team has been left behind because they were, for various reasons, unable to innovate in how they do employee communications. And I hope that people who read Mr. Editorial, the free version or the paid version, are inspired by seeing what other people are doing or saying or how they're communicating,
If anyone's interested, please do go to Sean's LinkedIn page. I was listening to the radio earlier today, and there was a fascinating debate on there. In essence, the discussion was about the fact that social trust in society, and certainly in Western societies, has been in decline for decades. Trust in politicians and other previously well-respected authority figures or public figures is at an all-time low, as we probably know. And that the breakdown of that trust has led us to, well, there's various side effects of it, isn't there? There's the mistrust of experts, in inverted commas. It's fueled the rise of things like conspiracy theories. It's led to the polarization of, you know, adult debate on social media. And I think people often accept that politicians lie as a matter of course. So they're not shocked when they discover that politicians have lied to them, anything but in fact. And against that backdrop, with the pandemic in mind, do you think that employees now turn to or trust their organizations more by comparison to those previously trusted figures or establishments as an edit of key news, you know, thinking about the pandemic, as I say, so that the edit and the curation of the news and the sources of information that we give people, and I certainly noticed this in the pandemic when I was working for a global construction firm, how actually valuable that edit is to people. And we probably shouldn't underestimate the level of trust that people put in us as curators and editors. And I just wondered how you felt about that.
It's a very good question. One, at least in the United States, there is no doubt that regular people trust their CEOs and companies more than politicians. I don't know about experts, but there's certainly a high degree of skepticism toward experts. And there has been in this country for a long time. The Edelman Trust Barometer that has come out a couple of times throughout the course of the pandemic has shown that Americans trust corporate leaders more than they do politicians, which puts corporate leaders in a really interesting place. With the social justice movement dominating the conversation and our politics in the United States last year, especially around the Black Lives Matter movement and disenfranchisement of minority groups, and a presidential administration that was built on and acted on lies, even for those who supported that administration, knew that there was great exaggeration in what was being said on a day-to-day basis. So employees had nowhere to turn other than their workplace. Consumers put pressure on corporate leaders to start acting publicly and taking political stances and filling the leadership vacuum that the federal government had abdicated. And as a result, I think corporate leaders have found themselves in a difficult position right now, because under the Trump administration, it was extremely easy for corporate leaders to be outspoken. President Trump would say something xenophobic or racist or anti-queer, and it was very easy for any corporate leader to stand up and say, we don't believe that. We don't stand for that. That's not our values. And now we have an administration with Biden in the White House who is more attuned or who is more socially progressive, who does not often say or rarely says anything racist, xenophobic, anti-queer, and so on, and in fact does the opposite. So now the screws are put to corporate leaders to not just say something, but do something. And that puts them in a really tricky position. Do they have to say and act on every socio-political brush fire that comes up? To what degree do they lobby? Do they become activists? Do they donate money? Do they take court cases to the Supreme Court? So on and so forth. Employees are just exhausted with the politics talk at work. And I know corporate leaders are exhausted with it too. Maybe it seems that some companies have gone too far in their activism, and employees just want a safe space to go where they can sometimes get a break from the noise that's happening in society. So it's a really interesting place for corporate America to be in right now. And I think corporate leaders want to get back to the business of running business.
One reflection I've got of the pandemic, and if you still consider that we're living through the pandemic, which I think we very much are, I think empathy, humility, leaders acknowledging that they don't have all the answers. And actually, I think maybe the toughest part for leaders and organizations is to sort of be in this public discourse with employees that they as leaders are acknowledging that large numbers of their employees may not be all right at any given moment. You know, they could be struggling financially, they could be having mental health struggles. I mean, that's a real difference, I think, pre-pandemic. You know, you'd never be having conversations like that out in the open, expressing that kind of vulnerability, making it acceptable. Thinking about internal communicators, this is not an original thought, because myself and so many others that have worked in this profession over the years have seen ourselves at various points as the conscience, or acting as the conscience of the organization. You know, to some degree, holding it to account, trying to get an authentic view of the world and the company's view of the world out to employees, transparency, all those things. But how difficult do you think it is to be the conscience of an organization in corporate America, for example, where actually there are certain business interests at heart that you have to sort of, a lot of internal comms can often be about reputation management. Our job is to make leaders look good, but also hold them to account. And that's difficult. You know, do you think everybody is actually empowered to do that in every case?
And that is the tension of being in employee communications, is to sometimes it is your job to communicate a point of view that you don't necessarily agree with. And it is never your job to play devil's advocate publicly within the employee public sphere there, to question that authority. And so I think that is a compromise that those of us who enter employee communications have to accept, especially those of us who fancy ourselves journalists, former journalists, or would-be journalists, who feel that it is our duty to hold power to account. But when you become part of the corporate communications function, that is absolutely not what you're supposed to do publicly, perhaps, you know, behind closed doors.
I meant to ask you this earlier, but about Splunk, your current employer, can you just give a brief overview of the organization and your role there?
Splunk is a technology company based in California. Companies use Splunk's cloud-based software to make sense of and act on immense amounts of data. So it's a simplification, but you think about any organization has a jillion points of data. They can immediately see and remediate a problem, whether that's like a potential security breach or something that might make the company more efficient. So for example, Honda uses Splunk to monitor their assembly lines. Whether a line is running fast or slow or something is breaking down, they can act on that information more quickly. Domino's, which is a pizza delivery food chain, Domino's uses Splunk as a way to make the consumer experience in ordering pizzas more efficient and pleasurable, whether that's through the app or online. Airbus uses Splunk to track parts of their supply chain and how things are moving through there. So those are some examples. My role there is the manager of employee communications for the products and technology group. That is the largest employee population of Splunk, and it consists mostly of the engineers and technologists that build the product.
One thing I was interested in, actually, just as we were talking there, was about hybrid working. We're waiting to see where we're going to land, you know, and there's lots of debate about will we be 2 days at home, three in the office. Increased use of technology, I think, is a given. But what, more specifically, what role do you think internal comms is going to play?
Where I think internal comms is really going to excel this year and into next year is through the storytelling aspect of employee communications, so that employees who are not in the office don't feel like they're being talked at, but they're being talked with, and that the communications that they're receiving from corporate feel less transactional and more conversational, and that the stories that they are able to access on the internet, in their newsletter, in print magazines, however it's manifested, connect those employees to their peers, whether it's same department, other departments, different cities around the world, so that they feel less alone. It is very easy to be an employee in an office, in a factory, wherever you're working, and to feel like you're a part of a community because you're in a physical space with those community members. Even if you're not talking with them, you have that shared experience together. But when you're sitting in a home office alone in a city nowhere near a headquarters, how do you provide that emotional attachment to those people whom you may never, ever meet? So I think it will be incumbent on employee communications to do more and better storytelling to connect those disparate employees and teams to each other so that they feel emotionally attached to the company. And if they're emotionally attached to the company, then they're less likely to leave.
Having worked in a lot of teams, great teams that have had external comms and internal comms sat alongside each other, and I think that's probably the norm now. It's pretty strange if you have communications teams, albeit with slightly different disciplines, sitting away from each other. They tend to all sit together now. So for example, you know, for listeners, that, just to be clear on that, I mean, you know, press, PR, media, public affairs, sitting alongside internal comms / HR, maybe with some marketing and client-related activities, all in the same team. And, you know, that's a thing that you've seen more and more of in the last 10 years. And actually, a lot of people from the external comms sphere who were, you know, great PR people came in to internal comms, saw it as more of a career path, and actually gave it a much needed kick up the backside and sort of sharpened a little bit of focus, you know, brought their own discipline to that. And I think that's a good thing. But I think, you know, given that companies, we increasingly use our employees as well as brand advocates, and we use them in external sort of activity. I wonder, you know, is internal comms even a thing anymore? Do you think we should even talk about internal comms?
It's a great question. I mentioned my mentor, Ethan McCarty, earlier. He and I have had conversations where we don't, in fact, at Bloomberg, and typically I don't like to really say internal comms, but instead prefer the term employee communications, because nothing that is said or communicated internally stays internally. And whether that's something more significant, like a leak to a news organization about an internal memo, or employees acting on social media, reflecting some of the news that they've heard in their company, or it's very simply employees talking with their spouses about what's going on at the company, or at the bar with their friends, talking about what's happening at the company. Nothing ever published internally stays internally. And so if you reframe your point of view from internal communications to employee communications, you at least recognize that those are humans who are acting outside the corporate and organizational walls. Social media is a genie that will not be put back in the bottle, and it should be embraced by corporate communications teams, and employees should be encouraged to smartly use social media to advocate for their company if they really believe in the organization and the product. And so you are right in that perhaps at some point soon, it will no longer be called external communications and employee communications, but it will just be called communications, and your primary objective may be a certain audience.
What hobbies and interests, if you've had time, Sean? It sounds like you're very busy packing quite a lot into your life. But if you do have any other hobbies and interests that you're passionate about, are there any things that have helped you just get through the lockdown period?
The one activity that's helped me stay centered is taking long walks with my fiance. We lived in New York City during the lockdown in an apartment, and taking walks on a daily basis where you could do nothing else was immensely gratifying for many reasons, physical and emotional and soulful. But we've continued that practice. We've moved out to the West Coast. We live in Oregon now, and where we want to be closer to nature. So taking long walks and embracing those long walks.
What's been your favorite book in the lockdown?
Oh, I really enjoyed two collections of short stories and one by Alice Munro. Not a new writer by any means, but a new writer to me. And I thought her character development was top notch, really, really worth studying. If you want to be a short story writer, I highly recommend her short story collections.
And my final question is, I don't know how easy or difficult you're going to find this to answer, but is there an interesting and or random fact that very few people who know you or are connected to you in the professional sphere would know about you?
Yeah, I'll break some news on your podcast. Nobody outside my immediate family and fiance knows that I actually run a used bookstore on eBay. And that actually one of my hobbies is rummaging through thrift stores and garage sales looking for valuable first editions and vintage books and buying them for 50 cents or a dollar and selling them for way more than that on my eBay bookstore. And it's, you know, I've had a few successes where I've purchased a book for $1 or $2 and sold them for $7,500. More than $100, because people just don't know what they have. So
I'm imagining the kind of the man with the cigarette from the X-Files style character who is sort of seeking out rare and mysterious books. that's the image that I now have. I don't know how accurate that is. It's probably way off the mark. Well, listen, Sean, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you today about your career history, all things comms, journalism, and more besides. So I just wanted to say thank you very much for being a guest on Comms from the Shed.
I want to thank you for the opportunity. I've enjoyed this conversation very much.
Thanks for listening to the latest episode of Comms from the Shed. Hit subscribe if you want to know when new episodes are available, or check out our Instagram page for the latest updates.